Jews knew how to survive, and now we've returned. Do you know how Jews still survive? They survive in the text. The art of composing is one that comes through some kind of nearly divine channel, divine inspiration, but it's depicted as the immediate, intense reaction to pain and loss and anxiety and suffering. That, at least, is the art of writing for Agnon. Everything about him, from his name to his date of birth to the date of his aliyah, his arrival in the land of Israel, everything was mythologized. Everything was part of the fable the author crafts about his own identity. Creativity, in all its forms, is the most authentic Jewish response to pain, to catastrophe, to exile, to destruction. Last week in our introduction, which we entered through the prism of Agnon's Nobel Prize speech, I spoke of the different tensions that he explores, the different transitions that he uses really as the basis of all of his writing, the transition from the old world to the new, the tension between tradition and modernity, between Yiddish and Hebrew, between then and now. And these are ideas we're going to come back to again and again, but perhaps no tension is more central to his writing than the transition between the diaspora and the land of Israel. In today's story, The Fable of the Goat, we see this depicted in masterpiece miniature. His presentation of this theme, which echoes throughout many, many of his works and stories throughout the large canon of Agnon's writings, is best entered like going into a cave through the story Maaseh Ha'ez, The Fable of the Goat, which was first published in 1925, precisely when Agnon himself re-entered the land of Israel. I had mentioned last week that I'll touch on different stations of his biography as we go along. Remember, Agnon was born in 1887, although he always said he was born on Tisha B'Av, 1888, August 8th, the 8th of the 8, 88. He came on Aliyah around the age of 20, claiming he arrived on the holiday of Lag B'Omer, 1908, on the shores of Jaffa. But in 1912, after already establishing himself as a rising star in the world of Hebrew letters, he left the land of Israel to go to Germany, a place he had never been to before, but which was very much the center of Jewish culture and the revival of a new kind of Jewish culture. And if we had more time, we could talk about what was happening in Germany in that period, and it really is quite interesting. I would draw your attention to a fascinating book by Amos Elon. The Hebrew author's work is available in English, called The Pity of It All. It's a portrait of German Jewry at that time, before and after, which would really fill in your knowledge of the world to which Agnon went, this world of the Yekes, the world of the German Jews. We don't know how long he was intending on going, but for a young man who had his sights set on one day receiving a Nobel Prize in Literature, he realized that his experiences had been quite provincial. His education, formal education, was hardly existent whatsoever, and he went to see the world, to see the big city, to see Berlin, to experience and taste life, and to kind of gain the experiences which become the raw material for writing great literature. World War I broke out. He was unable to return. He spent the war years in Germany as a citizen of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, an ally, of course, of Germany. He was actually susceptible to being drafted, which was the last thing he wanted to do, and spent a certain amount of energy trying to avoid that. During his German sojourn, he meets Esther Marx, the woman who becomes his wife. He meets Shlomo Zalman Shokin, the great patron of his work, who supports him throughout the rest of his life, as well as developing relationships with a whole variety of other very important figures. In 1924, the house he was living in Bad Homburg, near Frankfurt, burned down. His family was safe by the skin of their teeth, but all of his property, including his large library and the manuscripts of two nearly finished works, which he had foolishly forgotten to, I guess, save on the cloud or on a disk on key or something, went up in flames. And he said, "This is a sign, this is a punishment that we have tarried too long outside of the land of Israel. It is now time to return." And in the fall of 1924, he arrives back not in secular Jaffa, but this time in Jerusalem, where he resumes a completely traditional religious life, which he had moved away from in earlier mid-life. And Ma'aseh Ha'ez is composed during this period where he re-enters the land of Israel. And it's not surprising that somebody that makes that journey is thinking about the old world and the new and the movement from one place to the other. Although not set in Germany, set in Poland. Now, Poland, of course, Agnon never really lived in Poland. Agnon lived in Galicia, this region in what today is Western Ukraine. And at the time that he lived there, at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century, was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. But prior to the end of the 18th century, it was part of Poland. It was southern Poland. And the Jews in Germany saw Agnon as a Polish Yid, a Polish Jew, with all of the kind of looking down their noses at such a creature. Agnon has a collection of short stories called Sipurei Polin, the Tales of Poland, the Tales of Polish Jewry, and our story is situated in that. In the introduction to that collection, he brings a rather well-known fable. This is not original to Agnon, but it's Agnon's retelling of an existing piece of folklore. To summarize it, it's the legend of how the Jews first arrived in Poland. Of course, you know that in 1925, writing a story about Polish Jewry is a lot different than writing a story of Polish Jewry in 1945 or 1955. There were still very, very many millions of Polish Jews living in Poland. But how did they get there? So it's a story of Jews who were on the move. And they get to Poland, or what they call in Yiddish, Polin, and it turns out that they're very useful. And the king is happy to have them. Historically, this was true, of course. Jews played a very important role as middlemen within the Polish economy and between the Polish nobility and the peasant class. And while they were sojourning in the land, sojourning, of course, they never intended to stay there. A Jew never intends on setting up permanent residence anywhere in the diaspora. But while they're sojourning there, they discover, as it were, the texts of the Talmud are growing on trees. It's almost described midrashically as Eden, where everything is readily provided. The Talmud itself springs up from the soil of Poland. And they say, well, this is a fortuitous place for us to reside. And then the legend ends with a question of why do they call it Polin? Well, it's a kind of play on words. And the play of words, of course, is in Lashon HaKodesh, in the holy tongue of Hebrew, that a kind of divine voice came forward, a note fell from heaven, telling the Jews, Polin, dwell here in this land until it will be time for you to return to the land of Israel. Or in Agnon's telling of the well-known legend, it's kind of reversed. It's the voice of the Jewish people calling up to heaven to remind God that he, Polin, should dwell here with us until the night of darkness of exile shall end and you shall deliver us up to the land of Israel. In a different version of the legend, in Agnon's collection of stories about Buchach, his native hometown, he asks, how do the Jews come to live in Buchach, in this particular place where he was born? And he tells a story of Jews who were on their way to the land of Israel. But, you know, in those days, in the Middle Ages, Jews had a vague sense that, you know, we pray facing east, but they didn't know exactly where the land of Israel was. So they head off like pilgrims, headed east. And, you know, if you head due east from the Rhineland, you don't get exactly to the coast of Jaffa. And they get into the Polish forests when the snow starts coming down rather heavily, and they get stuck there. So they have to winter over there in Buchach, and while they're there, again, the royalty finds them to be useful, and they kind of get stuck. So the Jewish settlement in Buchach, many hundreds of years old, is really nothing more than an arrested aliyah. It's a story of Jews that are headed to the land of Israel, and they just kind of got stuck there. Maaseh Ha'ez picks up on these ideas of the voyage from Poland to the land of Israel. I mentioned last week that Agnon cannot really be properly considered a children's author. His work is really much more mature, although there are a number of stories which are very accessible to children, this being one of them. And this is, of course, one of the, usually it's the first story that school children will encounter when they find Agnon in their curricula. And it's also been the beneficiary of a number of illustrated editions. In 1925, when the story was published, it appeared simultaneously in an adult literary magazine and in an illustrated edition for school children. Here we see a copy of the cover of that edition, illustrated by the Bezalel artist Zev Rabban. He was a rather well-known Israeli artist. I have no doubt that you've seen other paintings by Zev Rabban from this period, from the 20s and 30s, very distinctively Israeli Zionist art, sometimes propagandistic art for visiting the land or for Jaffa oranges or all types of other things. And he was part of the Bezalel school movement, which Agnon felt a particular affinity towards, and we could talk about that on some other time. There's a more recent edition by my friend, the illustrator Shai Charka, which we also have available in an English edition, makes a wonderful gift. There you can see it, which is a kind of comic book version, or they call it a graphic novel these days. But when I was a kid, we used to call these things comic books. And you can see very clearly that Charka is influenced by Marc Chagall. In Chagall's paintings, very often we see depictions of goats, which were, you know, omnipresent in the world of Eastern Europe of the shtetl. Now here, even in the famous Fiddler on the Roof, if you can see on the bottom left-hand corner of the Fiddler on the Roof painting, there's a little goat climbing up on the roof to listen to the fiddler's song or some such. It's important to note, however, that despite the influence of Chagall on our imagination, Agnon's town of Buchach was not a shtetl. It was not a little Jewish town, or certainly not a small village of the Pale of Jewish Settlement in Russia. It was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and it was a very different reality. Let us enter the story of the fable of the goat. It's a very, very short story. It's only a few hundred words long, and you can read it together, and those with children or grandchildren, it makes for a lovely introduction to read the story together, either in English or in Hebrew, or again in these illustrated comic editions. The tale is told of an old man who groaned from his heart. In Hebrew, ma'aseh bezakein echad. Now in Hebrew, a ma'aseh is a midrashic opening. We are telling now the tale. But in Yiddish, a ma'aseh or ma'aselach are stories of a kind of different nature. So simultaneously, although of course written in Hebrew, Agnon conceives of his stories in Yiddish. So it's simultaneously a ma'aseh, a almost like a rabbinic tale, but it's also a ma'aseh. It's a kind of clever Yiddish anecdote about something which is going to try to dig at something deep. The tale is told of an old man who groaned from his heart. He was ill. The doctors were sent for, and they advised him to drink goat's milk. He went out and bought a she-goat and brought her into his home. Not many days passed before the goat disappeared. They went out to search for her, but did not find her. She was not in the yard and not in the garden, not on the roof of the house of study and not in the spring, not by the spring, not in the hills and not in the fields. She tarried several days and then returned to herself. And when she returned, her udder was full of a great deal of milk, the taste of which was as the taste of Eden. Not just once, but many times she disappeared from the house. They would go out in search of her and would not find her until she returned by herself with her udder full of milk that was sweeter than honey and whose taste was the taste of Eden. One time the old man said to his son, "My son, I desire to know where she goes and whence she brings this milk, which is sweet to my palate and a balm to all my bones." His son said to him, "Father, I have a plan." He said to him, "What is it?" The son got up and brought a length of cord. He tied it to the goat's tail. His father said to him, "What are you doing, my son?" He said to him, "I am tying a cord to the goat's tail so that when I feel a pull on it, I will know that she has decided to leave, and I can catch the end of the cord and follow her on her way." Now, Agnon, you won't have noticed this reading in translation, but in the Hebrew text, Agnon chooses a curious word for cord or rope or string, this thing to which the little boy, this leash, as it were, that the little boy ties to the goat. In Hebrew, Agnon uses the word mishicha. You can see I've put it in parentheses on the screen. Mishicha is a Mishnaic word, a rabbinic Hebrew word, which appears three times in the Mishnah. It would have been unfamiliar, or it certainly would have sounded antiquated to Agnon's contemporary readers in the 1920s. Today, I dare say most readers wouldn't have a clue what it is aside from easily understanding it in context. When Agnon is crafting the story, he has an arsenal of words he can choose from. There are plenty of good words in Hebrew for a cord or a string or a rope. He could have said chevel, he could have said chut, he could have said ritsu'ah, which is a kind of leash. But he chooses the Mishnaic term mishicha. This has something to do with a topic we touched on last week about the kind of struggle for how modern Hebrew should be reawoken, which layers of the language we should turn to in order to populate modern Hebrew's lexicon. But there's no doubt that the deliberate choice of this rather antiquated term mishicha is meant, although probably there's no etymological connection, although we can't say for sure, there's certainly a homonym here in choosing a word that contains the sound and rhythm and echo of the word Mashiach, Messiah. This is a story about redemption, or at least potential redemption, about the voyage from the diaspora, the bitter, dark exile, to the beautiful land of Israel. And the choice of this word is really quite deliberate. The youth tied the cord to the goat's tail and minded it carefully. When the goat set off, he held the cord in his hand and did not let it slacken until the goat was well on her way, and he was following her. He was dragged along behind her until he came to a cave. The goat went into the cave, and the youth followed her, holding the cord. They walked thus for an hour or two, or maybe even a day or two. The goat wagged her tail and bleated, and the goat came to an end. In the Hebrew, this is a rhyming couplet. Agnon, not a great poet, would often insert rhymes into the prose. In the Hebrew, it says, I mean, you can hear the rhyme whether you understand the Hebrew or not. V'kach hayu holchim shah o shtayim, v'ulai yom o yomayim, kishkesha ha'ez biznava v'ga'ata'a b'fiha. In other words, there's a lot going on in that line or two. There's a lot going on in that couplet. Right? It's the passage from there to here, from Poland to the land of Israel. Even though the boy doesn't yet know where he's going at this point in the story, and we, on our first read, don't yet know where he's going in the story, but I remind you that Agnon once famously said, any story not worth reading twice probably wasn't worth reading the first time. really, you should be reading these stories in advance of our sessions, and you should be rereading them, or perhaps our being together is the rereading. But having read it once, you understand this rhyme is the soundtrack of the voyage from Poland to the land of Israel. When they emerged from the cave, the youth saw lofty mountains and hills full of the choicest fruit, and a fountain of living waters that flowed down from the mountains, and the wind wafted all manner of perfumes. The goat climbed up a tree by clutching at the ribbed leaves. Carob fruits full of honey dropped from the tree, and she ate of the carobs and drank of the garden's fountain. The youth stood and called to the wayfarers, "I adjure you, good people, Hishbiati etchem, tell me where I am and where is the name of this place." I should mention as an aside, the most prominent intertextual source here is the Song of Songs, the biblical Shir HaShirim, which is, again, I mentioned it last week, Shir HaShirim, this allegorical story of two lovers, read rabbinically as the reunion of the Shekhinah of God and the Jewish people, which in Zionistic texts was often read as a story of the Jewish return and reunion with the land of Israel. So, "I adjure you" is a phrase borrowed, lifted from the Song of Songs, but so very many other phrases in the story are also from there. If you're able to read in Hebrew, this would be more apparent. So he comes out of the cave, he sees it's beautiful, it's technicolor, it's delightful, it's glorious. And he says, "Where am I?" It happens that I'm reading to my youngest daughter, The Wizard of Oz, right now. It's been many years since I've read The Wizard. I've seen the movie countless times, as I'm sure you have. I don't think I've read the original L. Frank Baum novel since I was a little kid. I read it, I remember exactly, while I had chicken pox in the elementary school. I had completely forgotten that that device used by the filmmakers, where Kansas is black and white and Dorothy exits the house after the tornado into Oz into Technicolor, that wasn't a filmmaker's conceit. It's there in the novel. Everything in Kansas in the first chapter is described literally as being gray, and Oz is described as being wondrous. The filmmakers didn't need to come up with that special effect. It's already there in the text. And that is more or less, I'm certain Agnon didn't know The Wizard of Oz, but that's essentially what's happening here. They answered him, "You are in the land of Israel, and you are close by to Tzfat, to Safed, the city of mystery, the city of mysticism, the city of Kabbalah in the Galil in northern Israel." The youth lifted up his eyes to the heavens and said, "Baruch HaMakom Baruch Hu," a phrase that we know from the Passover Haggadah, "blessed is the omnipresent, blessed is be he who has brought me to the land of Israel." Now, one might wonder, and perhaps you did when you read the story, why to Tzfat? And not even to Tzfat, but to nearby to Tzfat. I could imagine Tzfat, well, Tzfat anyway is a place full of mystery and mysticism, so it's as good a choice as any to set the terminus of the cave, of this magic passage from the diaspora to the land of Israel. But honestly, if you were writing this story, you might have been forgiven for choosing to have the cave open up in Jerusalem. After all, where for thousands of years were those Jews praying and facing and hoping, and was always to Jerusalem? So it's a kind of serious question we have to ask, why to Tzfat? And what is this magic cave? Now, first of all, Agnon is taking a rather well-known trope from literature, and specifically here from children's literature. The idea of magic passages, of the ability to get from black and white Kansas to Technicolor Oz, exists going back to the earliest recorded folklore. We're, of course, all familiar with that passage to Oz, or the wardrobe which takes us into Narnia, or Alice's looking glass that brings her to Wonderland, or Peter Pan taking us off to Never Never Land, and of course, who could forget Platform 9 3/4? The idea that there are magical passages that can take us from our humdrum everyday life, that after all is the experience of childhood, to a more magical, a more multicolored, a more fantastic land, is the stuff of all children's literature. What's interesting, of course, another common trope to all of these stories is we have to get rid of the parents. In all great children's literature, think about it. How many child protagonists in children's literature are orphans? A very great many. Harry Potter is an orphan. Dorothy is an orphan. She's being cared for by her farmer aunt and uncle, but she's an orphan. And presumably, we don't know where she is, where the parents are. They're absent. The children in C.S. Lewis's Narnia Chronicles, they're not orphans exactly, but they've been sent away. Their parents are absent, and they've been sent away to the care of a rather absent-minded professor in whose home they find this magical wardrobe, this magical closet that allows them to get to Narnia. And every child, of course, who read the book immediately checked the back of their closet, as did I, to see if you could really get there. Now, I knew perfectly well what was in the back of my closet, but nevertheless, you try anyway. You hope. We have to get rid of the parents. Parents are either dead or are incapacitated, like the father in our story. He's ill. He's not able to protect the son. The mother is nowhere to be seen in this story. Or they have to be off the stage, because every child reading a story knows full well nothing interesting ever happens when your parents are there. Parents' first job is to make sure you don't fall down the rabbit hole and be carted off to a different world or whisked off by the cyclone to Oz, right? Parents' job is anti-mug. It's to stop the magic and to stop the passage to a more miraculous world. They want you to eat your broccoli and do your homework. When Agnon comes to Judaize this story, to set it within a context that he can say something about this passage and this magic cave that leads from one end to the other, he didn't need to invent Narnia or Oz or Neverland. He had ready-made the magical imaginarium, and that was the land of Israel. Because for 2,000 years, Jews developed fable upon fable. The land of Israel, for a young boy in Poland in the 19th, 18th, 17th century, was just as magical as getting to Oz. It was just as distant as the dark side of the moon. And the daily turn to Jerusalem, V'techezeno enenu b'shuvecha letzion berachamim, the words of the daily prayers about God's return to Jerusalem and his bringing the Jewish people back from the four corners of the world only increased the power, the gravity, the pull of the land of Israel on the imagination of the young Jewish child. Agnon didn't need to create anything technicolor or fantastic. It was already there and present. But what is this cave? So, very often, both as a matter of a kind of a midrashic composition, and certainly Agnon made use of this in his writing, when you're coming to write a story which is in dialogue with the Jewish sources, you call down to central casting and you say, send up a magic passage between worlds. Send me a magic cave. And central casting sends up to Agnon in his study the cave of Shimon Bar Yochai. There is a city in the Galil, a small town called Pikiin. It's nearby to Tzfat. Today, it has a largely Arab population, although there is a very small Jewish group that lives there, and there's a very ancient synagogue which claims to be built on the remnants of a synagogue that had been built there after the destruction of the first temple. And there are paving stones that are part of the building, which, according to local tradition, were stones that were carted off from the destruction of the first temple to build a synagogue, a mikdash ma'at, a remote sanctuary in the Galil. Nearby to that town, nearby to that synagogue, there's a little cave. It's kind of in a, they built a square, a town square around it, and there's a spring, and there's a carob tree, which you can see growing over the entrance to this cave. And according to tradition, this is the cave of Shimon bar Yochai. The cave of Shimon bar Yochai is related in the Talmud, Masechet Shabbat 33. It's on page 33b in Masechet Shabbat. It's a story that's very often related on Lag BaOmer. It's the story of Shimon bar Yochai, who's very much connected with that particular holiday. We don't have time to read the story on the inside, as we Talmudists like to say, but you have the text, and I really do recommend taking a look at it if you haven't had a chance beforehand. But I'll summarize the story. Rabbi Yehuda was praising the Romans. The Roman occupying force, after all, did a certain amount of good things for the land of Israel. They established marketplaces, bridges, they built bathhouses. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, he didn't like this at all. He criticized it. He said everything they established only for their own purposes. They established marketplaces so that prostitutes would have a place to market their wares, and bathhouses to pamper themselves, and bridges only so they could collect taxes from those that pass over. So this got back to the Romans, who were not at all happy with Shimon bar Yochai, and they put the death sentence out on him. So Shimon bar Yochai and his son flee, and they hide in a cave. According to tradition, this is the cave in Pekiin. A miracle occurs. A carob tree was created for them, and a spring of water so that they could be sustained from the food and the drink while they were in hiding. And there they sat and studied Torah all day for 12 years, until Elijah the prophet comes and tells them the emperor has died, the death sentence has been lifted, and you're free to go. When they come out of the cave, they see people plowing and planting and sowing and working their fields. And somehow, after this intense period of solitude and spirituality and Torah study and being sustained, as it were, from the hand of God, they have trouble re-entering the world. And they have trouble looking at Jews who are doing such mundane affairs when, after all, there are holy pursuits to be had. They start looking at these people and zap, fire comes down and burns up everything they look at. A heavenly voice comes out and says, "Have you left the cave in order to destroy my world? Back to the cave with you." And they go back into the cave for an additional year. According to tradition, during that year, they compose the mystical foundational text of the Kabbalah, the Zohar. I will not discuss now the historicity of that statement, but it is a rather well-known, tradition that that's what happened in those 12 months. At the end of the 12 months, a divine voice comes again, allows them to leave the cave, and when they come out, the son, Rabbi Elazar, continues to strike at those pursuing worldly affairs, and Rabbi Shimon attempts to heal. Well, the story goes on. They see a man, an elderly man, holding two bundles of myrtle leaves. And they say, "What are you doing?" And he says, "Well, I'm taking home these myrtle leaves, these very fragrant leaves, for the Sabbath, you know, just like people are accustomed often to bring a bouquet of flowers for Shabbat." He says, "Well, why do you have two?" "Well, I have two bundles of leaves, one opposite Shamor and one opposite Zachor, one to remind me to observe the Sabbath and one to remind me to remember the Holy Sabbath day. And Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Elazar say, you see, the mitzvot are beloved on Israel, and perhaps we can find a way to live back in this world. Well, the cave that's nearby to Tzfat in our story is no doubt the cave of Shimon bar Yochai. In other words, Agnon, kind of playing off the Midrashic idea of the conservation of biblical personalities, that if there's an anonymous character in the biblical text, the rabbinic mind, the rabbinic imagination is always going to fill that in and tell us it must be someone we know. So if in an Agnon text, there's an anonymous cave, we don't know where this cave is, where it opens, where it closes, presumably it is the cave of Shimon bar Yochai. After all, I had suggested that as you read the two texts together to try to see the borrowing of different symbols. After all, the carob, the spring, the cave, these are all ideas that appear and reappear from the primary text in the Talmud into Agnon's story. The boy kissed the soil and sat down under the tree. He said, until the day breathe and the shadows flee away. Again, another verse from the Song of Songs. I shall sit on this hill under this tree. Then I will go home and bring my father and mother to the land of Israel. As he was sitting thus and feasting his eyes on the holiness of the land of Israel, he heard a voice proclaiming, Ba'u netze likrat Shabbat HaMalka. Come, let us go out to greet the Sabbath queen. He had exited the cave late in the afternoon on Friday. It's almost the onset of Shabbat. The Talmud records this custom of the holy ones of old, who on Friday afternoon would wrap themselves in their talit and go out to the hillsides to witness the setting sun, and they would cry out, let us go out to greet the Sabbath queen. And of course, in the Galil, in Tzfat and its environs, in the 16th century, we see the development of the Kabbalat Shabbat prayers. The Friday evening service, which is of course so familiar to us, was formulated there and then in that place at that time. Licha Dodi, Likrat Shabbat, Likrat Kala. These are all elements that are coming together in the story, which make us question not only where is the story taking place, but when is the story taking place? Is this story taking place in the 18th century? Is this story taking place in the 16th century? It's not clear, and presumably it's a fable which is beyond and transcends time. The boy wants to send a message back home. He cannot travel, of course, because it is almost the Sabbath. So he writes a note. He explains to his father in the most poetic of terms. If you've read the story, you can see that even in the translation. And he has an idea. How is he going to send a note? He doesn't have, his father, I guess, is not on Twitter. So how is he going to send a message back to his father if he himself cannot go? He takes the note, he rolls it up, and inside the floppy ear of the goat, he sticks it in. You know, goats have these long floppy ears. And he says, when the goat gets back to father, father will pat it on its head, the goat will flick its ear, the note will fall out, and father will know that I have made it safely to the land of Israel, and that he should follow in the footsteps of the goat to join me, to exit the diaspora, to leave the exile, where we will be reunited here in the Holy Land. But what happened? Well, the handwriting is on the wall. This is a tragedy. There's no way this is going to work out well. The text continues. The goat returned to the old man, but she did not flick her ears, and the note did not fall. I've color-coded the text here with Agnon's Hebrew. Those that can follow the Hebrew should be able to line up how the original and the translation work out, but these phrases become very significant, as you'll see momentarily. When the old man saw that the goat had returned without his son, he clapped his hands to his head and he began to cry and weep and wail. My son, where are you? Bini, bini, ayeka. My son, would that I might die in your stead, my son.
B'ni, mi yiten moti ani tachtecha, b'ni, b'ni.
So he went weeping and mourning over his son, for he said, an evil beast has devoured him. My son is assuredly rent in pieces. Chaya ra'ach al tahu, taraf, 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 b'ni. And he refused to be comforted. V'imo'en lehinochem. And he said, I will go down to my grave in mourning for my son. Ered el b'ni evel she'ola. Now, while there's hardly a sentence in this whole entire short story that does not carry some kind of intertextual hint or connection to, principally, to the biblical text, you understand the connection to the Talmudic passage is intertextual between the lines. The presence of certain symbols draws our attention to the text of the story of Shimon bar Yochai in the Talmud, but not the words themselves. Here, there's a whole variety of intertextual hints, which may be familiar to you. You may have caught the references, even if reading in translation. And what are these intertextual references? Bini, bini, ayeka. My son, where are you? Ayeka, where are you? Is, of course, the call of God to Adam in Eden after the sin. Adam and Eve hear the voice of the Lord going in the garden. The man and his wife hid from before the Lord God in the midst of the trees of the garden. And the Lord God called to man and he said, Ayeka, where are you? It's a rhetorical question. Surely, of course, God knows exactly where they are and what they've done. And he said, I heard your voice in the garden and I was afraid. Bini, bini, says the old man about his son. Mi yiten moti ani tachtecha. Would that I were to die in your stead. Of course, this is a reference to the second book of Samuel, to King David mourning the death of Avshalom, Absalom, his rebellious son. The king trembles. He goes up to the upper chamber of the gate and he weeps. And thus he said as he wept, O my son, Avshalom, Absalom, my son, Absalom, would I have died in your stead, O Absalom? Bini, bini, my son, my son. Now, these two mourning fathers, God, of course, Father in heaven, mourning not the death of Adam and Eve, but the spiritual death. They were, after all, intended to live eternally. And now that sin has entered, they have become mortal. Death has entered the picture. Ayeka is the call to a rebellious child. And David, in the most heartrending depiction of a father mourning his dead son, nevertheless, we must remember, Avshalom was a rebellious son who had sought to overthrow his father and supplant his kingdom. But nevertheless, the father mourns the death even of the rebellious son. Would that I would have died in your stead. Bini, bini. So these intertextual references, of course, are drawing our attention to that presumed death of the son. The father back in Poland thinks the son is dead. But it also introduces an interesting idea, which is nowhere present on the surface of the text. And that is how the generation behind in Poland viewed those that went through the cave. Of course, there was no magic cave. Would that there were such a thing. But of course, you know that the movement to Eretz Yisrael, the rise of modern political Zionism, was not something that was universally embraced by the old generation. It was seen as quite rebellious. It was seen as supplanting not the kingdom of David, but the Torah of Moses. There's a third intertextual reference. The father sees the goat and presumes the son is dead, presumes he's been devoured by a wild beast. That, of course, is directly from the story of Jacob mourning the death, the presumed death of Joseph. They bring him the coat of many colors, splattered with blood, and Jacob mistakes it, or is he's fooled, as it were, into thinking that Joseph has been killed. Chayara chaltahu, tarof, tarof, taraf, Yosef, v'yitabel al beno yamim rabim, and he mourned for his son many days, precisely as in our story. But of course, there's an irony to both. And here we should mention irony was Agnon's prime mode. What's the irony here? Both Jacob and the father in our story are mourning dead sons, but we, the reader, know they're not dead. Not only are they not dead, they are so not dead that they are thriving. Joseph has become, or will become shortly, the viceroy of Egypt. And the son who has gone through the cave has reached the technicolor land of Israel. Joseph is not only so not dead, Joseph will be the guarantor to make sure that the entire family survives. While dying of starvation in Eretz Canaan, they go down to Egypt in order to get grain, to get food. And then when they go down there for their long-term sojourn, it's only in the merits of Joseph and his political strings that he's able to sustain his entire family, who should become a very great nation, although they have to endure slavery before exiting. Not only is he not dead, he will be the source of future life of the family and the nation. Well, the father, thinking the son is dead, he saw the goat, and he would say, "Woe to the father who banished his son, and woe to her who drove him from the world." The old man's mind would not be at peace until he went for the butcher to slaughter the goat. The butcher comes, slaughters the goat, the note falls out, but it's too late. The goat having been slaughtered, he can no longer lead the father to the land of Israel. He knows he has destroyed his magic carpet. He has closed off the cave. But what happens to the boy? Since that time, the mouth of the cave has been hidden from the eye, and there is no longer a short way. And that youth, if he had not died, shall bear fruit in his old age, full of sap and richness, calm and peaceful in the land of the living. Mene az pi ha-me'ara samui min ha-ayin, v'derech k'tzara od ayin, v'oto bachur im lo met, od yanuv b'seva d'ashen v'ra'anan, b'artzot ha-chayim shaket v'sha'anan. And hidden between this kind of a charming little rhyme, Agnon reminds us that the boy thrived unless he didn't. Because, of course, many who did go through the cave did not survive. They didn't survive physically. The malaria got them. An Arab pogrom got them. Poverty got them. Or they left. A great many of those that came to Eretz Yisrael, particularly in the period that Agnon first came during the second Aliyah, a very great number could not survive and returned to the lands of the diaspora. But even if he does survive, the question is, does he survive spiritually in the way that the father would like? This is a story about distance. This is a story about transition. This is a story about a generation gap. But unlike so many other writers who treated this theme, Agnon is sensitive to both sides of the equation. Agnon is sensitive to those that stayed behind. Now, of course, writing in 1925, he could not have known what would be the fate of Polish Jewry who did not come through the cave. But even in 1925, there was a sense that this long experiment of Jewish life and thriving and creativity in the land of Poland was coming to an end. And the answer to what would become the Jewish question will be tzi b'ikve hatzon, follow the goat, go through the cave, come to the land of Israel. But it's a warning message to those that do come, that they leave behind those in Poland and their values and their traditions and their texts and their way of life at their own peril. That it's not enough to come through the cave. We have to maintain an ongoing Jewish culture and an ongoing Jewish tradition in order to keep the cave open and to keep the two sides in communication. And in that regard, it really is a quite remarkable story, following in the footsteps of the goat, the Ma'aseh Ha'ez, the fable of the goat, which engages with so many other important Jewish texts. I should mention, again, aside from these wonderful illustrated editions, one of which is available in English as From Foe to Friend and Other Stories. It's a collection of three stories in this comic book format. I should also mention an interesting book called Agnon's Tales of the Land of Israel, which was just released. It just so happens that I'm the co-editor of the volume. It's a collection of essays on Agnon's stories of the Land of Israel, including our own, for those that are looking to explore some more of these larger themes that unfortunately we won't be able to get to in our short course. What would our other writers have done with a character like this? Mendele would have made him ridiculous in order to twist and poke. Shalom Aleichem would have made him the object of simple mockery. I sweeten the bitterness of Rebutel's poverty, removing the ridicule, making the pauper a more perfect character, although clearly it would be better if we were not paupers.